Hi there, you're listening to Camille Parle Sexe, your sexual wellness podcast. I am Camille Bataillon, clinical sexologist, and in this podcast, I want to give you la crème de la crème in sexology. With my guest or on my own, we will reflect together on sexuality, human relationship, and every aspect of intimacy to give you the best of sex education. I hope to inspire you in your intimacy and put some glitter in your sexuality. Alors, bienvenue! Hi everyone, welcome to this first episode. I'm very happy to have a conversation with Cam Frether on this show to talk about men's sexuality. Cam is a professional sex coach, sexologist, counselor, and a tantric yoga teacher. As a coach, he helps men go beyond surface-level sex and into full-bodied, self-expressed, pleasure-oriented sexual experiences free of anxiety or shame. Wow, what a program! So please enjoy my talk with Cam. Hi Cam, welcome to the show and what a profile you have.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me as well. I'm really excited.
Yeah, well, it's a big deal because it's my first English interview for the podcast and I'm very happy that you are my first English speaker as a guest. So I know you since more than a year. I think I started to follow you on your Instagram page and then I discovered your podcast, Men, Sex, and Pleasure. And what I appreciate about you is first, you are a male sexologist, which I think it's still pretty rare. So you are a male sexologist with a modern approach. So I really like that. And I think to talk about men's sexuality, it's great to have an insight from a male sexologist and a sex coach. So my first question to you is, how is the sexuality of men doing today?
Yeah, that's a big question. So I'll try and sum it up in my own observations. Firstly, thank you so much for those kind words as well. That's really, really lovely. What I notice is I notice an over-medicalization and an over-pathologization of male sexuality in particular. I mean, sexuality in general, I think we've kind of over-medicalized and over-pathologized, but male sexuality specifically, because of this idea that like, male sexuality and men's sexual experiences are all around function, right? It's like whether the penis works or not, whether there is or isn't an ejaculation, whether there is or is not an erection, whether there is or isn't sex drive there. It's all about whether it's working properly. Mm-hmm. And so we diagnose dysfunctions, right? We diagnose problems. And that's very often how sexuality is treated in the West in particular. It's like, here's a problem that needs to be fixed. And typically it's fixed with a pharmaceutical, right? It's fixed with medication. It's fixed with...
Especially with men, right?
Yes, very much so. So we see like the rise of Viagra in the late 90s, early 2000s. And now we're seeing things like premature ejaculation, for example, being treated with SSRIs, with antidepressants, low doses of that, which I have an issue with. I don't think that that's a very conducive thing to be doing for like sexual exploration and sexual experiences. So that's like what I see with male sexuality is it's like it's very much function oriented. And it's like, how do we fix this dysfunction? I get that in messages from men every day. Like, they ask me, I have erectile dysfunction, and I want to get and maintain an erection. And like their terminology, the way they talk about their sexual experience is like, I'm dysfunctional, I'm broken. And they've never been diagnosed with erectile dysfunction. They've never seen a clinician, that you need to meet criterion to get that diagnosis, right? And so a lot of the guys that I talk to who say they have quote unquote erectile dysfunction don't actually have a clinically diagnosable dysfunction. They just aren't getting as reliable erections as they would like, right? And so there's a problem with our language there as well around male sexuality. So a really useful phrase that I learned from another male sexologist, actually, his name's Chris Donahue. He talks about erectile disappointment, for example, as opposed to erectile dysfunction. And so...
Yeah, makes more sense.
Well, yeah, exactly. It makes a lot more sense because there's this expectation that male sexuality has to look a certain way, right? It's you can expand that conversation to like, well, that maybe comes from porn, it maybe comes from our peers, it maybe comes from the women who have the same stories about male sexuality that men do, and so all these expectations about what a penis should and shouldn't do and what male sexuality should and shouldn't look like create these unrealistic expectations. And I get guys that self-diagnose themselves with premature ejaculation, for example. And again, that's a clinical diagnosis. You've got to meet certain criteria. And when I dig a little deeper, a lot of these guys don't have premature ejaculation. They just ejaculate before they or their partner are ready to, right? And again, we don't have the language to describe what it is that we're experiencing. So all this is to say, oh, yes, go ahead.
Sorry. And even when they have sexual, you know, dysfunction, like as, you know, as you call it, or like a premature ejaculation, it's not necessarily a problem. Sometimes they can go, like seeing a sexologist saying, I have this problem. And then when you ask, like, you know, like, does it bother you? Not really. My partner, she kind of like it as well because she doesn't like when it lasts too long. So actually there is no problem. And they just think that since men needs to last longer and for a long time, then they have a problem and a sexual issue where obviously they are very happy about their sex life.
Yeah, you're 100% right. There's like these stories that we have about like male sexuality. And so like, you know, one of those stories is like sex has to last a really long time and men have to last a really long time. And you know, mm-hmm. that leads to other issues around, like, for example, delayed ejaculation, right? Which it goes very underreported, is men that struggle to actually ejaculate, right? They actually can't get to their climax, which is becoming more and more prevalent because we're talking about it more and more. But a lot of guys think, well, that's not a problem, right? That's not an issue because I should just be able to last all night long. When actually, well, it is an issue because, you know, it causes distress and it causes tension. And, you know, there's a lot of symbolism and meaning that we attach to an ejaculation, right? And I can speak maybe more into that, but there's this approach to sexuality, I see, at least for men, of being very like, fix my problem, I've got a problem that needs to be fixed, and it's not pleasure oriented. Yeah, fix with pharmaceuticals, fix with medication. So it's not, you know, it's not pleasure focused, it's not expansive and exploratory. It's just very like, male sexuality is just straight and linear and narrow and, you know, not nuanced, not complicated. It's just like, do this thing, get an erection, get an ejaculation, you know, roll over, go to sleep. Like, that's how a lot of people and men in particular frame their experience of sex. So my mission, I suppose, is to like really challenge that and to really break that stereotype down and to really offer alternative ways of thinking about your sexual experiences and expanding and exploring them. So that's my roundabout way of getting to that answer that question.
So it's like, yeah, what you've noticed is like for men, and when we talk about, you know, the sexuality of men is based on performance, pressure, body function, right? More like on a mechanical thing rather than, you know, like a more holistic things, like how do you feel? What do you want also? Like, how is your body feeling? And pleasure wise, more than like, I need to get an erection, I need to ejaculate, and I need to make my partner come as well. Do you see any difference between the sexuality of straight men and gay men, or what are the big challenges, you know?
Yeah, I do see a little bit of a difference. I think there's a inherent sense of exploration and maybe even a sense of rebellion from like really heteronormative ways of experiencing sexuality that gay men, because of their process of like exploring their sexual identity and having to come out, kind of gravitate towards. Now, that's a very generalized statement, and I've kind of like worked with predominantly straight men. I do work with some gay men, and from my experiences, you know, working with these gay guys, they do seem a bit more exploratory. They are open to a bit more exploration. Something that they come up against is like really having to challenge that like penis-centric heteronormative way of like, intercourse, I suppose, which is like penis goes in vagina, is like the very stereotypical way that we define sex. And so because that is not the type of sex that gay men are having, right, because there's no vaginas involved, they, part of their process of exploring their sexuality is like inherently challenging that really stereotypical narrow way of defining what sex is. So I think that's the major difference that I kind of see. There's a bit more exploration of bodies as well. So, a lot of straight dudes that I work with and from my interactions with straight guys on the internet, and you know, I'm straight as well, so I can speak from experience. There's fear and reluctance and resistance to exploring their body. And the
Why is that?
I think that one of the major reasons is because there's a fear of being labeled gay, or there's a fear of being labeled weird, or there's a fear of being labeled strange or something, you know, that isn't normal, right? Because the very narrow way that we think about male sexuality is like guys just masturbate, you know, go through the motions. They just look at porn. It's very simple. They just masturbate like a little chimpanzee. They get an ejaculation and then they are finished, right? And the same thing with sex. Guys are very simple, linear, narrow. And so anything that deviates from that, anything that like diverges from that very simple way of thinking about male sexuality is considered by a lot of guys kind of weird or extra or not necessary or, you know, or gay, right? And so there's, you know, God forbid I talk to a straight dude about exploring his ass, for example, right? And maybe prostate stimulation and anal play. That's a big fear that guys have because of what it might mean about their masculinity, what it might mean about their sexuality. So they place a lot of meaning on the exploration of their body, and that oftentimes that meaning is detrimental, the way that they framed it anyway. But oftentimes it can be very liberating with regards to your sexual experience and your sexual identity and your masculinity as well. A lot of the guys that I work with who have done exploration of their body, and that's something I kind of coach them through, is how to move away from just like this very localized area of their body, which is their genitals, and you know, experience full body pleasure. They become a lot more secure in their sexuality, a lot more secure in their masculinity. They become a lot more pleasure focused and pleasure oriented, and the sex that they have is a lot better than when they weren't doing that before. So it ends up being very transformative for them. But I see a lot of resistance to that, particularly in straight men.
Yeah, because it requires them to challenge the script, as you were saying. Like for gay men, they're already like, since they are gay in a society that, like, you know, are more like heterosexual, they already have to challenge the script. They already feel rebels, and they are like more like, okay, let's explore like all the sexuality and let's go really like full in. While for like the heterosexual men, they've been taught something and they never really question it. They are like not very flexible about changing the script because a lot of fears, as you were saying. And I really feel like sometimes is a very like, it's narrowing their sex pleasure, right? Because they are only doing one thing and they are not very willing to explore other things. As you were saying, when you work first on being secure about to explore your body and your sex life, then they can discover even more and expand their sex life.
Yeah, very much so. I think there's like so much, you know, I'm a big believer that sexuality is inextricably linked to who we are as human beings. You know, like our understanding of our sexual self and our sexual identity informs the way that we show up in the world, right? Like the way that we interact with everyone, really, whether it's a family member or a lover or an authority figure or a subordinate, like whoever we are interacting with, our understanding of our sexual self plays a part in all those relationships. And so if there's like this part of our identity, this part of ourself that we feel a lot of shame about, or that we haven't fully explored, or that we don't really understand, we don't have a robust understanding of, then that's impacting all of those relationships. And so like my belief, I suppose, is like, if I can help men really explore and understand their sexual self, that'll then not only, you know, create a better relationship with their own body and their own self, but that'll extend then to, you know, a better relationship with their partner, maybe a better relationship with their kids, maybe a better relationship with their community. And they'll interact with the men in their life a little bit differently. They'll interact with the women in their life a little bit differently because they're understanding boundaries, they're understanding consent, they're understanding pleasure, they're understanding, you know, what turns them on and how to ask for those things and when to say no and how to listen to no and how to respect no and things like that. So I definitely think it's this ripple out effect. And I've definitely seen that a few times with some of the clients that I've worked with when I check in with them about how they're relating to the people around them. But that's my grandiose vision, is we can change the world if we start to just like work on sexuality a bit more.
But I completely agree with you, because sometimes we just think that sexuality is just a little checkbox in our life, while actually, when we work on our sex life and understanding better what we like, what we want, our boundaries, what we don't like as well, and how to communicate about it, it also implies that it's going to be the same also in other aspects of our life, right? We're going to be able to communicate our boundaries also at work, in our family, with our kids. I mean, it has a lot of impact. And about communication, as you were saying, what I see in consultation, and you will tell me if it's the same for you, but mostly in consultation is women who come, during sessions, or if it's a man, it's a man in a relationship. But I don't really see single men coming to take care of their sex life, because it just feels like they don't care, or they don't take care of their sex life and of their sex life and their sexuality. And what do you think it's about? Like, is it because of their education, or because going in session and in therapy, it requires as well to work on yourself and challenge, right? Challenge your script, challenge your belief. And sometimes it can be scary as well. But what do you think, like, it's a barrier for most of single men, or just men in general, to come in therapy?
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And we can't discount the fact that historically guys have been terrible at going to seek help for things, right? Like, there's statistics out there that men don't go and see doctors when they're feeling unwell, right? They don't seek. The stereotype of men not asking for directions, things like that. So there is this this historical kind of precedent of guys not going and doing that type of work. And I think also as well, sexuality work in particular, there's a very strong narrative that men need to be knowledgeable and assertive and have sexual prowess, right? And to admit that to go and seek help for sexuality is to kind of admit that you don't know everything, that you aren't maybe as sexually powerful or have as much sexual prowess as you maybe thought that you did, or that you do need some help in the sexual department. And so that's the bane of my life, is getting men to come and seek help from me. And I often think there's
how you do that, huh?
I know. it's interesting, right? Because I have some guys who are really looking for a male coach to work with, or a male practitioner to work with, because it's they find it maybe easier to talk to someone who can relate to their experience. But I also get guys who maybe I do a call with, and I say, well, I think I'm feeling there's a bit of resistance here. I don't know if we're going to be the best fit. And I'll refer them on to a female colleague of mine, a woman who I work closely with. And she'll report back to me that they were very reluctant to speak to a guy, but very open to speaking to a woman. And
And when men come, they're like, I'm super happy that you are a female sexologist, because I don't want to talk to that with a man, and when you ask why, they're like, well, we don't talk about this with our friends, with our male friends, and I don't feel comfortable to talk about it with another guy, because there's maybe comparison, what he's going to think about me, and even if it's a professional, right?
that's what I have definitely noticed, is there's a lot of men, in particular men, their approach to sexuality is based on competition, right? How do I compare to someone else? Am I a better lover than this person? Do I have a bigger dick than this person? Do I last longer than this person? Do I give this partner more orgasms than her previous partner did, right? And so because of that, when it comes to guys opening up about their sexuality to other guys, you hit the nail on the head. A lot of this comparison story, competition can come up for them. They can feel reluctant to share, because what if this guy, Who is this guy? Why does he think he's better than me? And I've had that with some clients, and it's been actually really powerful to move through when that's been acknowledged. And I often try and, not share too much about my personal life in coaching, because I noticed that can trigger some of that comparison and competition piece for clients. But and I also notice on social media a lot, if I share something and guys are like, who the fuck are you to talk about, how to have better sex, who do you think you are, kind of thing. Not that I haven't gone to school for it for 7 years or anything like that, but it's just interesting to see how guys react to advice about sex from other guys, as opposed to it from a woman. But then there's the other experience of things, is a lot of guys will listen to men as opposed to listening to women. A lot of guys, you know, when it comes to advice about dating, for example, a lot of guys will listen specifically to men, and there's a whole, you know, subculture of men online who specifically don't listen to women because maybe there's some misogyny there, and there's some maybe a bit of I would go as far as to say like some hatred to women as well, and so they only specifically listen to men. And yeah, so it's just a very interesting, you know, people are interesting, you know, and so there's a whole wide range of experiences.
It's through life, like to trying to understand, you know, what about the people. And it's true also in when a heterosexual couple comes, like usually the woman will say, it's been, you know, years I'm trying to bring in session, but it was like, no, we're gonna find ourselves, I'm gonna look online. And you know, so the man is like, yeah, I try my best, I wanted to do it on my own, but okay, I realize I can't. And at, you know, when it's very the limit, the big crisis in the relationship is like, okay, I need help. I have to admit I need help. And it's very difficult for them. But you're right what you're saying. It's sometimes the work to do also to guide them through all the emotions, the resistance. And also in a heterosexual relationship, women wish that their partner like can open up a bit more emotionally or feel closer to them. How can you get a man to open up emotionally? What does he need to know in order to do it?
Yeah, I something you said there reminded me of like something that I try to say often, which is people seek help either out of a place of desperation or inspiration, right? And so a lot of men will seek help from a place of desperation, right? Like it's, I've tried everything, things are broken, the straw's broke the camel's back, I don't know how to fix things. And so I really try and those clients will reach out, but what I really try and do is like encourage people to reach out from a place of inspiration as well, right? It's like, oh wow, I learned about this thing. I learned about multiple orgasms. That sounds incredible. I'd love to learn more about that. Like, can you teach me about this? And those are really like, I mean, I love working with all my clients, but the clients that are working from a place of inspiration are like joys to work with because they like want to learn, and there's like this inspiration to like learn something new and to explore things. So that was something
I they're already in a good mindset, I feel. Like they're already in the right mindset. So yeah, they come with the right mindset already because they are motivated, they are inspired, and they can, you know, they're like just, they're hungry like for having a lot of information and trying new tools and discovering, versus when it's already desperation, they're already like pessimistic. And sometimes sadly, it's already too late because there's a lot of frustration, a lack of communication, and it can take a lot of time and efforts to make the relationship great again. So how do you help men when they come to you? And is it a desire from men to be more to open up more emotionally, or it's more like a request from their female partner?
Yeah, I definitely notice a bit of both. It's probably about 50-50 in the work that I do. So I get single guys working with me, and I get guys in relationships. And you know, to tie this into the question that you asked before, like how can we encourage men to open up a bit more? Like part of that is like encouraging them to go to therapy, encouraging them to go and seek coaching, encourage them to speak to someone who isn't you. You know, a lot of times men in relationships, when they do start to open up, because this is the only person in their life that they feel comfortable opening up to, will then start to like unload everything onto their partner. And that's not, you know, a healthy dynamic either, right? We don't want to go from stonewalling and not opening up at all to unloading everything. We want to find a happy medium where, and that happy medium, at least in my opinion, is struck when you have a third person that you can go and speak to. A minimum of a third person you can go and speak to. Yeah, it'd be great if you had a support network of people, but at least one other person in your life that you can like have a conversation with about what's going on for you. And you know, that's where a coach or a therapist or someone comes in. And you know, people have this misconception that you need to see a coach or a therapist because something's wrong and you need to fix it, which is, you know, from that place of desperation. But you can go for maintenance, you can go for, you know, upskilling, you can go for learning something new. It doesn't have to be because something's wrong. That's especially true for like couples as well. Like there's this idea that, oh, if we see a relationship counselor or we see a sex coach, it means that something's wrong in our relationship, and that doesn't have to be the case. It doesn't have to be that you have a problem. It can be just because you want to learn something new and you want to try, you know, explore a new avenue of your relationship.
are taking care of your relationship, it's also a big message to the universe, like, we are going to therapy because we are taking care of our relationship, and our relationship is something important for us.
Yes,
and I totally. Think we have the right, the, we have the same mindset of like, you know, it's, we want to, that people can come like anytime in their relationship, but even more like at the beginning of the relationship to install, you know, like good baseline and not necessarily waiting for problems. And when they have the right tools, they can also face better the challenging than they're having in relationship and seek help more easily as well, because it's something with that there's no shame or no guilt, because they know like, it's, okay, we are taking care of a relationship and it's something important for us.
I 100% agree. And to like give your listeners some specific things that they can do if they've got a male partner, these are very generalized, I admit, but I found them to be useful in my work. And because I get a lot of women ask me, like, how can I get my male partner, my husband, my boyfriend
to open up?
So here's my generalized suggestions. The first is, if you're going to have a conversation with him about something, my initial suggestion is have that conversation when you're doing something physical together. So when you're going for a walk together, or when you're going for a drive together, or if you like going bike riding, maybe when you're having like a little bike ride together, or whatever it is, when you're, I play football, play soccer. And so I would kick a soccer ball around with my partner and we would have a conversation at the park and just, you know, whilst we're kicking soccer ball around. And the reason why I suggest that is because it's a really simple but useful way for getting men out of their head and into their body. Right, it kind of snakes past that over analyzing, like, oh, what if I say the wrong thing type of whatever could be going on for him, and helps him just
feel. But can he do two tasks at the same time?
Well, that's the idea. Like, they don't really, like, you know, that's the stereotype. It's like they don't really, they are focusing on the activity, and so like the free flowing thoughts are able to come out. They don't stop themselves from saying something because they're focused more on the physical aspect of it, and it gets them into their body as well. So that's a very simple practice, you know, just go for a walk and have a conversation throughout the walk, as opposed to like, you know, we need to talk and sit down across from the dinner table at them and, you know, like an interrogation or a police interview, you know, and kind of staring them down. The other suggestion that I have is kind of like, two suggestions here, I suppose, but like, you know, ask a question and give him space, right? So some people call this like the 30-second rule, like ask a question and then wait 30 seconds for an answer. And then even wait, like after you've counted 30 seconds in your head, wait another 30 seconds. And there's a woman by the name of Alison Armstrong whose work I like. I don't like everything that she does, but I like this idea of her analogy of sending the bucket down the well. So give him time to like send a bucket down the well, you know, fill it up with water and pull it back up and let him pour that, you know, the contents out and share his feelings, so to speak. So, you know, give him a bit of time. And in relation to...
Sorry to get you. Is it open questions or like closed questions? Like, you know, it can be like a yes, no answer, or it has to be more elaborate?
I definitely suggest open questions. Like, you know, closed questions, like a yes, no answer is like, you know, really good for like finding out specific things, like did you do this or did you do that. But when you're, you know, talking about feelings, you know, and this is just a very simple, you know, micro skill from counseling, it's like open-ended questions can allow him to have a bit more to say, right, as opposed to like, you know, a closed question. And my follow-up to that, I suppose, would be if he does share something, because we can get excited that he's sharing something, right, we can get enthusiastic of like, oh, thank God, he's like, we can tend to jump on him then with extra questions, right, and we can start to go, you know, oh, tell me this, and that for a lot of guys that aren't used to talking about what's going on for them internally, that can get overwhelming. So you know, kind of hold your tongue a little bit when it comes to like asking questions. I know it's exciting and can be, you know, like, oh, thank God, he's finally opening up, I can ask all these questions. But like I said, that can get a little bit overwhelming. So so give a bit of space. You know, it's essentially holding space for him to be able to like, okay, what's coming up for me? I've got a bit of time to process this. So, you know, I'm not going to get bombarded with 50 questions after this about this particular thing. It gives him an opportunity to like share and yeah, have it well received. And you know, related to that as well is like, and I do this still, so I'm mindful of this, is like, if you ask a question, and it's hard not to do, but try not to have the answer that you want in your head when you ask that question as well, right? Because when we do that, especially if we're asking a question that's like quite sensitive and it's like about the relationship or it's about the sex that we're having or whatever it might be, oftentimes we're looking for a particular answer. And if we don't receive that answer from our partner, if they say something else and we go, well, that wasn't the answer that I actually wanted, we can get maybe a bit defensive, or we can get a bit critical about their answer, or we can go, we can maybe get a bit frustrated or agitated by what they've shared because it wasn't exactly what we were looking for. So, and that's a very easier said than done, I must say. Like it takes a skill to be able to like suspend that judgment, right? And to just allow what's coming up to come up.
And then also, because if you are like already in your mind, like wanted a certain type of answers, you are not a good listener because you are not paying attention really of what the other one is saying.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, you're already thinking about, you know, this particular answer that hasn't even been said yet and where that conversation could potentially go. The other suggestion that I have when it comes to helping men kind of open up and talk a little bit more is, oh my God, I've just lost it. I was just about to say something there. But
it's evening for you, so take your time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's nighttime here. So my strategy, I suppose, for getting men to share with me, I suppose, and I am very selective how I do this, but is to like almost lead by example a little bit, right? Is to encourage them to share, I'll share a little bit. So I'll be vulnerable. I'll start with sharing a little bit of my own personal story. So the reason why I do actually so many podcasts, to be totally honest with you, is because I try and share a bit about my life and have that out there so that the guys that reach out to me are familiar with like, oh, these are things that Cam's overcome. He's gone through some experiences of premature ejaculation and, you know, erectile dysfunction and things like that. So so that is my suggestion to people that have male partners is, kind of create that opportunity for him to share by inviting him into it. And that invitation looks like you being a bit vulnerable. It looks like you being a little bit open. You know, if it's specifically talking about sex and like desires, for example, it can be really helpful to start by sharing what turns you on, right? And if you want to know what turns him on, you can start by saying, you know, I really enjoy it when you do this, for example. You know, do you enjoy that? You know, and he might be like, yeah. Or you know, you can say, what do you enjoy when I'm doing this? You know, that really turns me on. What do I do that really turns you on? You know, and so you can kind of foster that vulnerability and that safety and that courage, right? Because it's a courageous thing to do, to kind of speak up and admit what turns you on and share that with a person. It's a you know, very intimate part of yourself that you're sharing with them. So it does require, you know, I like Brené Brown's kind of definition of vulnerability and risk-taking and you know, the courage that it takes to do that. So creating a space by like leading by example is kind of the analogy that I think of is like dive into the water first and reach out a hand to your partner and say, come on in, the water's fine.
Come on in because it's safe also.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and you were talking about sex drive, and for the men who are listening to us and are like, okay, like I have a low libido, I would like to share it with my partner. Okay, I share it because, you know, like it's important for a relationship, we are in a safe relationship, so I can be vulnerable. But then the next step is like, how can I increase my sexual energy and my libido?
Yeah, so you know, sex drive and libido is an interesting one, because it's, you know, the term sex drive is like not entirely accurate, right? Because we don't necessarily have a sex drive in the sense of like our other drives for hunger, for example, or for thirst, right? We're not going to die if we don't have sex, you know, like we would die if we don't eat, you know. So the idea of a sex drive is a little bit
except if all humanity is not having sex, we're all gonna die.
Yeah, so from a biological essentialism perspective, yeah, where we might, you know, our genes might not be passed on, but yeah, so something to like be mindful of is desire, right? So instead of talking about libido, it's talking about desire, right? What's your desire to explore pleasure, your desire to be intimate with your partner, your desire to masturbate, your desire to have sex. And so desire is a lot easier to work with then, as opposed to like sex drive, which is this elusive, like, you know, are we talking biological drive? Are we talking, you know, psychological? What are we talking about? So desire is what I like to work with. And, you know, when it comes to desire, it's important to recognize that there's kind of like two main experiences of desire. There's spontaneous desire and there's responsive desire. So spontaneous desire kind of being, you know, the desire to have sex that just kind of comes out of the blue, like, whoa, I'm horny now and I want to do something about that. As opposed to responsive desire, which is like doing something intimate and, you know, so starting to kiss your partner or starting to give them a massage or maybe even getting a massage, your partner comes and starts to nibble on your ear. And by virtue of them doing that or you doing that, you go, oh, this is turning me on. Oh, I want to do something, you know, more with this, you know. And so it's where desire comes after starting to do something physical. And a lot of times, you know, we frame desire as spontaneous, and that if we don't have spontaneous desire, then something's wrong with us. And so,
especially with men, this is what we expect from men.
100%. Yeah, you're totally right. And there is some like statistics to suggest that men, on average, experience more spontaneous desire than women do, but that's not universal at all. And so one of the suggestions that I have to is, you know, because I work with men explicitly, the suggestions I have to them is like cultivating a pleasure practice or a self-pleasure practice. And, you know, I frame it for a lot of guys. I use a lot of sporting analogies because it tends to help. I frame it like going to the gym. So like I speak to them about, you know, are there times that you don't want to go to the gym? And they're like, fuck yeah, there's times that I just can't be bothered going. I'm like, well, do you go anyway? And they're like, yeah, I go anyway because, you know, I'm like, all right, well, why do you go? It's because, you know, I know it makes me feel good. I know it's good for me. I know that, you know, at the end of it, I'll be thankful that I did it. You know, it's part of my routine. You know, I have discipline and integrity with that. And so I'm like, okay, all those same reasons are very valid and applicable reasons to do a self-pleasure practice, right? Where, you know, there'll be times where, you know, and I, you know, within self-pleasure, I encourage them to do like 20 minutes of touching their body, slowing down, breathing. Maybe it involves a little bit of porn, maybe it doesn't. Yeah, it's just an exploration of like what turns them on and what feels good, right, in that moment. I don't use the term masturbation very often because it's got a lot of baggage. It's got a lot of negative connotations to it. And self-pleasure for me feels a lot more broader. And it's really, as the name suggests, what you yourself find pleasurable. And that may or may not include genital stimulation. So I say, look, 20 minutes a week. And oftentimes I'll get them to expand on that and start to do maybe 2 20-minute sessions a week, 3 20-minute sessions a week. But the idea is like, do something that feels good in that moment. And that could just be sitting there and maybe just holding your body. It could just be breathing. You know, the act of breathing feels really good. It could be going for a walk and noticing the senses, right? So, you know, sensuality is really important here in a very literal sense of the word. Like, what do you smell? What do you hear? What do you taste? What do you see? What do you feel in terms of the touch? And so like getting them to explore that and, you know, specifically like explore that in a way that feels good for them is really helpful for them exploring like the responsive side of desire, right? And so they start to do something in their self-pleasure practice like, whoa, this is actually really enjoyable. This feels really good. And it starts to diversify their experiences of pleasure. It starts to diversify their the way that they notice their arousal. And by virtue of doing that, then they that gets expanded to their relationship with their partner, right? And their sex life with their partner. And so instead of thinking that like, you know, desire has to look like spontaneous desire for penetrative sex, which is like how a lot of men think about, you know, what sex should look like, it starts to then broaden their horizons when it comes to like how they can intimately connect with their partner or sexually connect with their partner, how they can like explore their sexuality with each other. And maybe it isn't really like gung-ho, gusto, you know, strong libido, you know, rock hard erection, you know, every single time. Maybe there are opportunities to like explore a little bit more softer, nuanced, you know, slower forms of sexual intimacy, maybe that don't involve a penis and a vagina, but involve like some fingers and, you know, maybe some kissing and a massage or just sitting with each other, holding one another, you know, breathing together, being naked, you know, tuning into each other's bodies and co-regulating your nervous system. Maybe that's what that sex, you know, again, this is a broader definition of sex, looks like for you in that moment. So that's like my approach, I suppose, is like really starting to like diversify experiences of pleasure, diversify, you know, feelings of arousal, and then expanding that to how you interact with your partner. And one of the strategies for thinking about this is like your erotic menu, you know, like when you're hungry, you choose from your menu a dish that you want to eat. And when you're horny, you choose from your erotic menu a dish, you know, quote unquote dish that you want to eat. And for a lot of couples, for a lot of people in general, there's only one dish on their erotic menu, right? And that's penetration, it's intercourse. And so,
and it can be quickly boring for most of the people, right? Especially women also.
Right. So imagine if you're eating like that one meal from your menu for the rest of your life, right? Every time you're hungry, you only have this one meal, and it might be your favorite meal, right? It might be the best meal that you've ever had. But if that's the same meal that you're having every single time that you're hungry, like you said, it gets boring, right? But there, you know, some other things that might, you know, be problematic is that it might be something that you are really hungry for, but your partner's not really hungry for. Or it might be something that your partner's really hungry for, but you're not really hungry for. Or, you know, it might be your partner might only be a little bit hungry, and this is a really big dish, right? And so maybe it's a bit too much for them, or vice versa. You might not be super hungry, but you just want to nibble and just want to pick at something, and your partner might be really, really hungry. But if you've only got this one dish on the menu, you're starting to compromise, right? And that leads to people crossing boundaries, and people maybe, you know, putting up with things that they don't necessarily want to do, or doing things that they aren't necessarily into. You know, and it doesn't allow for a multitude of different experiences. So adding things to your erotic menu is the way that I go about this. And I've had clients, you know, draw up their menu, their erotic menu. I get them to A3 sheet of paper, and they take photos of them and their partner, and they find pictures from the internet, and they draw it all up, and they have this thing that they can, you know, kind of arts and crafts together with their partner. But it can just be a mental exercise, right? It's just like adding things to your repertoire of sexual experiences. Like, what are some other things that you can do that have your sexual needs in mind that you and your partner can do?
Yeah, and so we can see that communication is very important, because if there's this menu and nobody's talking about the menu, we just think, oh, everyone is happy about the menu and we are not talking about it. It can lead to frustration as well, and having like a not satisfying relationship. And what you're doing in your work with them is to think again about this menu, to add new things as well, and to especially add things that they could love, no matter like what other people are saying or what society are expecting from them. Just like going from, you know, their own pleasure and their own body and what they want to explore with themselves first as a solo experimentation, and also with their partner, and communicate also their desires.
Totally. And you know, it sounds so cliche, and you said this, but, you know, communication is so key, right? Like, it's just such a necessary part of life in general, but particularly sex and relationships. And I see so many people, you know, this is just an observation, I suppose, but I see so many people doing things sexually with their partner or with someone else that they don't even feel comfortable talking about. You know, like, they go and do the thing, and they haven't even had a conversation about it beforehand. And that is the opposite way of how we should be doing things, right? We should be having a conversation about something and feeling comfortable enough to actually talk about it, what turns us on, what our boundaries are, what we're into, what our fantasies are, what we desire, what turns us on, all that sort of stuff, before we actually start to enact those things physically. But I see a lot of people just diving straight into the physical and not even like having conversations about, and not even feeling comfortable having those conversations, you know? Yeah, it's the opposite way around that I'm seeing a lot of people.
So it's to think and then we can act. But usually in our society, we act and then after we think about it. And then sometimes it's too late because, you know, sometimes our body boundaries have been crossed, or we are not sure about what we like, and we do things that we don't necessarily like, but we need to talk about it before going into action.
Yeah, and you know, conversations about sex don't have to be super serious. You know, I think there's like this misconception that like if we've got to talk about our sex life, it's like, oh God, like we've got to have a talk about, you know, again, something that's wrong. Again, you know, I think because we've framed, you know, conversations about sex as being like, oh, something's wrong, we've got to fix it. But conversations about sex can be really playful and can be really, fun and exciting. And there's so many activities that I use with my clients to help them have conversations, because like it can be tough to initiate a conversation about sex as well, right? Like there's a lot of fear, a lot of tension, a lot of stress, a lot of like, worry about what could come up. And so one of the suggestions that I have for people, but you know, for the clients that I work with, is utilizing a game called the Yes, No, Maybe So game. Just a simple PDF list of like all these sexual activities. And you sit down with your partner over a glass of wine or over a cup of tea. And again, in like a non-sexual situation, and you just sit down and you go through this list together and you indicate, you know, on all these activities, are you a yes? Are you a no? Or are you a, yeah, maybe if the mood strikes me and, you know, the setting was right, I could get into that. And the beauty of it is like, if there's something that you're into, like I always use the example of group sex, for example, if you're into group sex and that's something that, you know, maybe you watch that type of porn and it's something you fantasize about, and it's something you would, you know, kind of like to do, but feel really uncomfortable bringing that up and acknowledging that to your partner, utilizing a game like the Yes, No, Maybe So game, which has on there like group sex scenarios, you can like use this game as a way to initiate a conversation about group sex because it's just on the list, right? It's like, oh, look at this thing that's here in amongst all this other amazing stuff. Hey, I'm a yes to group sex. And your partner might indicate they're a yes or they're a maybe. It's like, oh, wow, you're a maybe. What are the conditions under which you'd want to explore that? You know, it kind of helps take the burden of the initiation, right? Because that is what's stopping a lot of people from taking, you know, a conversation about sex, you know, to their partner is like the fear of initiation. So bringing a game or something playful to your partner can be a third person. Yes, 100%. Yeah. Even listening to a podcast together, listening to this podcast together, yes. Right? Listening to, you know, reading an article together, watching a TV show together. You know, there's all these ways of like lifting the burden of that initiation.
Mm. But I'm pretty sure, like you were saying about podcasts, but I have some couples who sometimes listen to the podcast and they listen, the two of them, or sometimes individually, but then like they are coming together and just share, oh, what did you think about this episode? And at this moment when they talk about this, like, you know, it's, podcasts are great tools, right, to communicate about sex, especially the podcast around sexuality. So I think it's a great thing. I wanted to ask two final questions. So first, like, what do you wish for men's sexuality? What is your vision for men's sexuality? You already a bit said, but like, okay, what do you wish for them?
Yeah, I guess I'll piggyback on what I shared before, but like my wish and my vision for like male sexuality is for it to be like opened up, you know, like I want to lift the lid on, you know, Pandora's box of male sexuality, because there's so many things around like, you know, multiple orgasms for men and the separation of orgasm and ejaculation, the way, you know, sexual experiences fluctuate throughout the lifespan, you know, the refractory period and the way that's like talked about. And you know, again, the very linear, narrow way that we think about male sexuality, even in like the clinical setting, one of my life ambitions as a researcher and as a, you know, sexuality professional is to really challenge the model of, you know, male sexual response that we use from the 1960s, Masters and Johnson's model, and create a new way of, you know, interpreting and you know, analyzing male sexual experiences and making it a lot more nuanced and in depth. So that's kind of my vision, my wish for, you know, male sexuality and men in particular, is for them to really explore like the spectrum of pleasure and the spectrum of their experiences and to feel comfortable doing that. And I said before, the reason why I think that's going to be a really powerful thing is because that's going to start to impact their relationship with themselves. It's going to start to impact their relationship with the women in their lives, the men in their lives, their lovers, their children, right? They, you know, be sexual role models for the people that are around them. You know, I think there's so much power in like men really starting to explore their sexuality in like really healthy, open, and vulnerable ways. So, yeah, that's my vision and my wish.
It's very powerful. So I wish the same. Yeah, I really wish the same. And to finish the podcast, do you have any recommendation for the men who are listening to the show, like any books, any tools, anything that you can share with our audience?
Oh, yeah. So the Yes, No, Maybe So game, I definitely recommend that. You can Google that. That's an easy one. Some books that would be great to read. I'm currently reading at the moment Sex When You Don't Feel Like It by Cindy Darnell, which is a fantastic book. We kind of talked a little bit about what we mentioned before about like responsive desire and things like that. She talks a lot about pleasure. It's a fantastic resource. What else am I looking at here on my bookshelf? Off the top of my head, something along the lines of like, you know, there's a fantastic book called Mask Off by J.J. Bowler, who's a poet from the UK, and he talks about like men's mental health, and he talks about like his book Mask Off is a reference to like the masks that we as men tend to wear. And so some of those are masks around sexuality, like what does it mean to be a sexual man? I kind of alluded to that before. It means like being powerful and dominant and assertive and in charge and things like that, which, you know, causes a lot of issues for men and for the people that they have sex with, because no one's really educating people around sex in a really healthy, pleasure positive, sex positive way. And so it creates a lot of issues. Mask Off by J.J. Bowler is a fantastic little book. There's heaps of other resources out there. If people want to know, they can reach out to me and I can share things.
Exactly. We're going to put all the resources and all your information also on the note of the episode. If people want to reach you out, please do not hesitate, because Cam is doing a great, great job, a great work. So it can really help your sex life. I will put also the book references. And you're right. Sometimes we put men in the box and they put a mask on. So it's very interesting to understand what's happening, you know, in our society about men's sexuality. Thank you so much, Cam. I'm very happy we did this recording together. I'm very thankful that, you know, it's very late for you and you are here on the podcast. So I'm very grateful. Thank you very much.
No, thank you so much for using your platform to have these conversations and for inviting me on and for you know, allowing me to speak in English. You know, I apologize that I don't speak French. That would have been amazing. I'm really grateful that you're platforming to English speakers as well. Thank you so much.
I try my best. Thank you, Cam. Thank you. Bye-bye.